For WTOP News, it's The Book Report. I'm Tariq King. Jeff Bennett is co-anchor and co-managing editor of PBS NewsHour and a political contributor to MS Now and NBC News. He's reported from the White House under three presidents. He's covered six presidential elections and was part of the PBS NewsHour team that earned a Peabody Award in 2024 for his coverage of the Israel-Hamas war. And he's out with a new book called Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy from Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms. Black Out Loud is out now from the Harper imprint of HarperCollins. Jeff, thanks so much for being on The Book Report today.
Tariq, thanks for having me, and I really appreciate your interest in the book.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. You know, this is one of those books, I think. There are some books that you read once and you're done with. I think that this is one of those books that I'm going to come back to because there's just so much entertaining information to absorb. There's a single question that I start off with every author, no matter who I'm speaking to. I always ask this question: what is the book about?
Well, this book, Black Out Loud, it's a cultural history of a remarkable moment in the 1990s when you had this wave of black sitcoms and sketch comedy. Martin, Living Single, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, In Living Color, A Different World. And what was really striking about this is that they were all on television at the same time. There wasn't a single breakout hit. They were all on TV, competing, cross-pollinating. They were funny. They were entertaining. But they also did something deeper. I think, you know, week after week, they introduced millions of Americans to black families, to friendships, to workplaces and communities. And they also reflected for black viewers all of these different versions of black life that were specific and that were authentic. And that's why those shows resonated. So I really wanted to, with this book, understand how that moment happened, why it had a lasting impact on American culture, and then all that led up to the 90s, that seminal moment in television.
All that led up to it, indeed. But, you know, before we get into that, I just have to ask you, you spend your days covering the news. What made you personally want to tell this story about that period? Why is it so important to you?
Well, a couple of things. One, covering politics, and I've covered national politics for more than two decades now, but covering politics teaches you that laws and policies matter. But from where I sit, I think that culture often moves people first. So culture shapes how we see one another. And those sitcoms helped expand how Americans understood black life, not through arguments or policy debates, but through laughter. And there is an intersection between culture and society that has always fascinated me. Now, people always think of The Cosby Show in this regard, right? Like, you wouldn't have had a Colin Powell or a Barack Obama without The Cosby Show exposing mainstream audiences to this aspect that had never been seen before on television, which was an upper middle class black family. But that lens had never really been applied to 90s sitcoms, the entire landscape of 90s sitcoms. And so that's what I sought to do with this book.
Yes. And even before you get to the 90s, over 20 chapters, you trace the story beginning with minstrel shows and ending with Chappelle's Show. There's a thread that kind of runs through all of them. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there really is a singular DNA that runs through all of it. And the DNA of black comedy starts with minstrelsy and vaudeville. And, you know, even under minstrelsy, under segregation, performers developed coded language, these double meanings that in a number of ways that allowed them to build this audience rapport, but it also allowed them to slip in truths because comedy lowers people's defenses. And those strategies created under constraint became the foundation for later breakthroughs. So you see the same DNA in some of the work that Dave Chappelle was doing to some of the work that, you know, Billy Kersanz or even Stephen Fetchett was doing generations prior. And so in understanding the 90s, you know, when I approached this project, I thought I would sort of approach it with the instincts of a journalist, but with the heart of a fan. And so the heart of the fan is really what drew me to the 90s, the shows I grew up with. But my journalistic instincts kicked in when I started talking to the celebrities and the actors and the producers and the showrunners connected to those shows and understanding what influenced them. And what I found was that you would not have had any of those shows were it not for Richard Pryor. And then it was, well, who influenced Richard Pryor? Oh, it was Flip Wilson. Well, who influenced Flip Wilson? And so on and so forth. And that's how you get to the very beginning of our understanding of black comedy in this country.
staying with the pre-90s for just one more minute, that we move from minstrelsy forward through folks like Hattie McDaniel. Let's start there. Why do you think it was important to include Hattie McDaniel, who I think that most people think of as more of a dramatic character actress, or maybe they think of her personal life as dramatic, I don't know, but they think of Hattie McDaniel in connection with Gone with the Wind, right? But why do you think it was important to include her in this group and in this story arc?
Because she in so many ways was the first. I mean, to your point, people would never think of her necessarily as a comedic actress, although she did work in radio on a show called Beulah and was able to really express the full range of her acting talent, comedic and otherwise, in that realm. But by the work that she did in Gone with the Wind, by her Oscar win, by the work that she did under the constraints of, obviously, Jim Crow and systemic racism, not just in the country, but within Hollywood, I felt it important that you couldn't understand the work that was being done on television in the 70s, 80s, and 90s without understanding the work that she was doing in film and radio decades before.
It felt to me in the book that a special turn or kind of leap forward in that timeline happened with someone else, Moms Mabley. Maybe she didn't quite negotiate with those same constraints in the same manner anymore. So I think that when you talk about the 90s, we think about Living Single and all those women who were shining so brilliantly on that show. But did Moms Mabley walk so that Queen Latifah and Kim Fields could run?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And what's so interesting about Moms Mabley is that character of her. The woman, the older woman in the muumuu on stage and the floppy hat and her purse, and would be disarming because you get the visual image of a older grandmotherly figure. And the second she would start talking, she would crack these jokes about race and home life and racism, aging. And it was funny on two levels. One, because of the visual image you were getting, but also because the jokes were so funny and resonant. And that really is what really speaks to her brilliance. So it definitely, her work definitely opened doors. But the other side that I've learned through my reporting, the other side of black comedy or just black folks in Hollywood, period, is that we've always had to prove ourselves time and time again. Even with a show like Living Single, Queen Latifah and Kim Coles, who had a development deal at Fox, they still had to prove that they could launch a show with four female leads and that it would be something that people would want to watch. You know, forget about the fact that it would be talked about 20, 30 years later. But that has always been the story in Hollywood. Even, you know, all of the success that Tyler Perry had, all the success that Ryan Coogler had with Black Panther, you know, he still had to prove himself to be able to get financing and the production of Sinners off the ground. The story of black folks in Hollywood has been that it's never been enough. You always kind of have to prove yourself and prove your worth.
And here we are talking about the 90s, 30 years later, and folks are still having to prove their worth, right? So what does Black Out Loud essentially say is the thing that makes that moment, that particular moment, culturally possible in the television industry? What were the forces that gathered there?
It was the combination of talent, timing, and creative freedom. You had comedians like Martin Lawrence. You had writers and producers who had come up through shows like The Cosby Show and A Different World. You had networks that were looking for younger audiences. And the result was this burst of creativity. So these shows felt authentic and energetic and deeply rooted in black culture because the people in the writers' rooms were writing stories and jokes that were specific to their lives. And I interviewed Barry Diller, the media titan who created Fox Broadcasting, and he told me that when they launched Fox, they knew that they had to differentiate because at the time, ABC, CBS, and NBC were fundamentally indistinguishable in terms of their primetime programming. Like, the sitcoms were all fundamentally the same, and so he knew that Fox had to be edgy. And the first pilot they got was for a show called, at the time, Not the Cosby Show. That was the name of the pilot. It went on to become Married with Children. The producers knew what Fox was looking for, and they were intentional about saying, this is the antithesis of what you would see on NBC. And Diller told me that once they knew that, that basically created a formula for everything else. So that's what allowed for Akeen and Ivory Wayans to basically create out of whole cloth in Living Color, and Martin Lawrence to have his show, a Living Single, to be on the air. It was a business decision, but it was also a business decision that was rooted in allowing these folks to have creative freedom.
So so interesting and so serendipitous that it was that simple business calculation that created what is now looked upon as I would call something of a golden age of TV comedy, these sort of legacy television pieces. And what obviously made them special were the creative people who made them, the people inside of them, a number of which that you actually interviewed for this book. You interviewed Martin Lawrence, Quinta Brunson, Yvette Lee Bowser, Kenan Ivory Wayans, and so many more. Based on your reporting and based on those interviews, what did you come away with about the importance of Black creators actually controlling the storytelling?
It's hugely important. And if that weren't the case, we wouldn't be talking about these shows some three decades later. What is so striking about that era is that the more authentic and specific the shows were, the more resonant and popular they became. And it wasn't just that they were popular with Black audiences. They were popular with all sorts of audiences cross-racially. And these were top-rated shows. Just look at the difference between the first season and the second season of A Different World. The second season of A Different World, Debbie Allen came on as the showrunner because the first season wasn't doing so well in terms of the ratings and in terms of the quality of the actual season. And she came on, having gone to Howard, was very specific, even down to the outdoor, sort of outdoor cafe that is a set piece for that show. She went down there, the pit, and was looking around and said, "Why is there no hot sauce on these tables?" And then the set dresser came in and put hot sauce on each of the tables. And you'll remember, folks who remember that show remember, you know, there were step competitions and there were things that were very specific to HBCUs that were evident in that show. And that was not the case in the first season when it was a different crew that was running that program.
I think it's important that people understand that it wasn't Bill Cosby. It was a Cosby Show spinoff.
Right.
But the driving force creatively wasn't Bill Cosby.
No. And what's also funny about that was, as it was told to me, he wasn't entirely convinced that the show would do well. So one of the ways he's created some distance between himself and that show was to have it tape in Los Angeles. The Cosby Show was recorded in New York. And so the thinking was, well, if this show doesn't do well, and it was also launched as a vehicle for Lisa Bonet at the time. And so the thinking was, if it doesn't do well, well, then we have the literal physical distance to say, well, it wasn't really connected to the Cosby Show, even though it was in the sense that it was a spinoff. But Yvette Lee Bowser, who was a writer on that program, a writer and producer on that program, who would then go on to create Living Single. And the other thing that is striking about this is that most of these folks, for the most part, were in their late 20s, early 30s, to include the stars and most of the comedians and writers in the writer's room. So they were doing this work, and they did not know at the time, as many of them have told me, they did not know how culturally significant it would become. But they were doing this work at relatively young ages, which is another thing to keep in mind.
You're a journalist, but you began the book saying that you were 10 years old watching In Living Color when it first started. So I imagine that you came to it with a sense of wonderment and perhaps nostalgia and learned some real truths about what it took to accomplish those things.
I think the thing that struck me the most was just how bold and inventive they all were and how unafraid they were. I mean, In Living Color completely changed sketch comedy. Martin was loud and physical and unpredictable. Living Single was smart and stylish and centered on Black women professionals in a way that was rare at the time. And even today, those shows feel fresh. But for Kenan Ivory Wayans to create a sketch show like that, when the entire talent pipeline had existed and was built around SNL, so he had to go out and find David Alan Greer. He had to go out and find Jim Carrey and Jamie Foxx, all of these people who were now stars in their own right. On The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, I mean, just the story of that show, how Will Smith auditioned for that show in Quincy Jones's living room during a house party for the chairman of NBC at the time. And he didn't want to do it. He was afraid. And Quincy Jones basically said, look, you want to be a star, because, you know, he had a name for himself as a rapper. But as is so often the case with a lot of musicians who, you know, get paid in lump sums without the taxes being paid out. He didn't do his taxes properly, and he was broke, and he needed the next big thing. The next big thing for him was going to be television. And so Quincy Jones said, look, if you want this show, you better go in there and audition. And he did, and the rest, of course, is history.
For readers who grew up watching those shows or who are watching them now, what do you hope that they will see differently about them after reading this book?
I hope readers come away appreciating how powerful storytelling can be, that the shows of the 1990s, they made people laugh, but they were also expanding the country's cultural imagination. And what it does, it serves as a reminder that sometimes the most meaningful social change doesn't happen in politics. It doesn't, you know, start with policy. It really starts in culture, and it gets embedded through culture. And that, to me, is why these shows matter.
All right, so speaking of culture in general, today we're seeing this new generation of comic talents breaking through on streaming platforms and social media. Do you see today's voices building on the legacy that you document in the book?
I think so. What's different, though, is that we don't have a monoculture anymore. So we don't have as many shared reference points. Now you could potentially have, 8 billion storytellers, every person on the world with a cell phone telling their own story. And that is how younger generations now consume media. You know, they're watching YouTube Shorts or watching TikTok. What's missing, though, is that half-hour sitcom where a family sits down in a living room together and has those communal moments. I remember the day after Criss Cross performed on In Living Color, a bunch of kids came to school with their clothes on backwards because what they saw on Living Color was Criss Cross rapping with their clothes on backwards. That, for the unfamiliar, that was their like trademark.
I thought that was so clever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't pull it off, but I thought it was really cool.
No, I was a sweater vest kid. I wore sweater vests to school, so I wasn't about to put mine on backwards. but that's what's missing. And so, you know, kids these days, I don't even want to name check, but like Drewski or Mr. Beast, I don't want to show my age by calling out people who might not be as hip or whatever to folks who are actually sort of native to that environment online and consuming that stuff. But it really is no match for what we had back in the day when on a Thursday night you had Martin and Living Single and then A Different World after The Cosby Show. And on Mondays you had Fresh Prince. And then Sunday nights you had In Living Color. And there were just so many different versions of Black life and comedy on TV at the same time. And you saw yourself and you saw parts of your family represented back to you on television. Like that was huge. That was seminal. It was impactful. And we don't have it anymore. And it makes me sad, frankly, that we don't have that anymore.
Before I go, if someone's in a bookstore and they're eyeballing Black Out Loud and they're wondering what kind of reading experience they'll have should they pick this up and bring it home, what would you say to that person?
It'll be a fun read, which I think we need so much more of in these fraught, fragile times. It's a fun, informative read. For folks who grew up with these shows, you'll learn a lot. For folks who are just rediscovering these shows on streaming, you will understand why that era mattered. And you'll walk away with a deeper appreciation for Black comedy as a vehicle, really, for social change across the different generations.
Black Out Loud, The Revolutionary History of Black Comedy from Vaudeville to 90s Sitcoms is the book. Jeff Bennett, thanks so much for being on The Book Report today.
Thank you. I appreciate you and I appreciate the invitation.
And I thank everyone for listening to this edition of The Book Report. For WTOP News, I'm Tariq King.